Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Oh, yeah! Welcome to another edition of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. I'm Pat Johnston, and I know there are many of you who loved having this 80-degree weather, but it's October in Michigan, man. I mean, I want some cool, crisp morning kind of days. I mean, I cannot believe I'm still utilizing my AC unit in the beginning of October. I want to open up the windows and snuggle under the blanket on cool fall mornings here. I mean, mid-Michigan is not supposed to be this warm during this time of year. Parts of the UP were in the 80s this week, and that's definitely not supposed to be the case in early October. We're seeing that Michigan is not immune from climate change, and coming up in the next segment, I'm going to discuss how the right-wing Mackinac Center for Public Policy is fighting any kind of clean and affordable energy legislation that the Democratic majority has introduced and is trying to pass. And in my last call this week, I'd like to say a few words on debating with others, but also trying to realize that there are still things that bring us together. Not everything has to be political. I know, that's sort of funny coming from me, right? My guest this week had to cancel at the very last minute, and they greatly apologized, and they said that they would be back in a few months, and I said it would be A-okay. My guest wrote a book on American fascism, and they said that they'll be able to talk more about it right after the holidays, so I will have that person on then. So that means you get a solo Pat Johnston show here this week on Left of Lansing. Next week, I'll have Sarah Lazare on the show. Now, Sarah is the editor for Workday Magazine, and she wrote a column in both Workday Magazine and The Nation Magazine about how the daily repetition of an assembly line worker can do long-term damage to the body. And that's one reason why one of the UAW's requests to the big three Detroit automakers during the strike is for a 32-hour work week. Sarah talked with assembly line workers who've suffered numerous injuries to their necks, backs, arms, legs, and that's all due to the long, repetitive work that they endure. And these injuries can lead to a life filled with pain. So Sarah Lazare from Workday Magazine will join me to talk more about that and also about what to expect from the UAW strike, which is entering its third week. That interview will take place again next week. Okay, I have to say a word or two about this news since it's now part of American history and will now forever be a trivia answer.
On this vote, the yeas are 216, the nays are 210. The resolution is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table. The office of Speaker of the House of the United States House of Representatives is hereby declared vacant.
What can I say? Couldn't happen to a nicer fella. 8 right-wing MAGA House Republicans and the entire Democratic minority in attendance voted to oust California Republican Congressman Kevin McCarthy from the Speaker of the House chair. McCarthy now becomes the first Speaker of the House ever in American history to be removed. The vote was 216 to 210, giving Florida Republican con man Matt Gaetz a victory in his motion to vacate. In total, 8 Republicans joined in voting to vacate McCarthy's position. Now, there was some talk as to whether or not Democrats would vote to save him. But that was not to be the case. And I know Democrats played this one right. I begged them on Twitter or X to do the right thing and to not give this guy a lifeline. He didn't deserve it. First, Kevin McCarthy is a slimy weasel of a man. He took the position despite it taking 15 rounds of voting. I mean, any other person would have had the dignity to say, perhaps it's time for me just to bow out. This is embarrassing. But no, he kept fighting and he made every concession to the extreme right-wing Republicans in the House who kept voting against him, which included giving them the right to vacate his position whenever they wanted. He did that to himself. But McCarthy didn't care because he wanted the power. He wanted to put his nameplate on the Speaker's office door. So, McCarthy has nobody to blame but himself for doing whatever it took to win the nomination a few months ago, and it came back to haunt him. Second, House Democrats already helped McCarthy avoid a government shutdown for the next 6 weeks as they voted to pass a spending bill to keep the government open. Remember, members of his party were the ones trying to shut down the government. And then, to show his satisfaction and gratification to the Democrats, what does McCarthy do last weekend on those Sunday shows?
Well, I wasn't sure it was going to pass. You want to know why? Because the Democrats tried to do everything they can not to let it pass. They did
were the ones who voted for this in a larger number than Republicans to keep the continuing resolution alive.
Did you watch the floor yesterday?
Oh, yes. Okay, 90 Republicans voted against it.
There was Margaret Brennan from CBS's Face the Nation in real time fact-checking Kevin McCarthy, telling her audience that Democrats voted to stop a shutdown from happening, while his Republican colleagues in the House voted for the shutdown. He bashes the Democrats while never holding his own caucus's feet to the fire. Right then and there, the Democratic leadership was right to tell their members to vote to vacate McCarthy's position. And it's not like McCarthy ever gave Democrats a reason to vote to keep him, considering how he cozied up with Trump and the extreme MAGA base of his party. Michigan Democratic Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib said in a message on X, "Speaker McCarthy has played a dangerous game with the lives and livelihoods of our residents. He has consistently pushed an extremist agenda, yet he's still not extreme enough for his own party. I voted for the motion to vacate to hold him accountable." And then Michigan Democratic Congresswoman Hillary Scholten posted a statement on X on why she voted on the motion to vacate McCarthy's position. And here's what she had to say. "I voted for the good of democracy, for the good of the institution, and as always, most importantly, for the good of my district and the freedom of this great nation. That meant I voted to vacate the speaker chair and remove a man who threatened those things. Congressman McCarthy voted against certifying the 2020 election results. He has abused this institution, undermined its purpose, and time again gone back on his word. Trust is foundational to our work in this body. A speaker needs to trust the majority to lead, and Kevin McCarthy squandered that trust. Today, in many ways, is even more difficult as we watch our Republican colleagues descend further into chaos, blame, and anger. Instead of bridging a path forward, I came to Congress to get things done. I am one of the most bipartisan legislators in my freshman class and a proud member of many bipartisan groups. I remain ready to vote for any speaker, candidate, Republican or Democrat, who will lead with principle and honesty." Well, Congresswoman, you're right about that. And we know that Kevin McCarthy, if anything, was never principled. I mean, both Congresswoman Tlaib and Scholten are absolutely right. McCarthy buddied up with Trump shortly after the January 6th terrorist attack on our Capitol building and on our democratic institutions. McCarthy pushed for impeachment hearings on President Biden to placate his master and MAGA cult leader, dear leader Trump, even though no evidence existed to impeach Biden. McCarthy basically allowed extreme Christian nationalists like Marjorie Taylor Greene to run the party in the House of Representatives. McCarthy made too many deals to keep, which is why he lost key members of his caucus. The guy is a loser, straight up loser. And he's one of the worst in Washington. He really is. He's just there to placate and enrich his donor base. He and his fellow Republicans who voted in desperation to keep him have no one to blame but for themselves for putting all their trust and power into Donald Trump. He owns the party, not them. And that's why I'm a little apprehensive on whether or not President Biden should run for re-election. No, I'm not saying President Biden hasn't done a fine job. He has. And I'm not saying that I wouldn't vote for Biden next year. Hey, whenever it's a decision between an old guy who will fight to keep democracy or an old guy who's clearly losing his mind while he hopes to build an autocracy in this country, along with his MAGA brown shirts, who will do whatever it takes to win, even if that means through violence, I'm voting for the old guy who's working to save America and her institutions. So of course I would vote for Joe Biden. It's actually not even a decision at all. It's about doing right and wrong. But in last week's Friday short, I said the following. You see, in order to defeat Trump next year, Joe Biden has to win by about 4 percentage points to guarantee that Trump doesn't win via the Electoral College once again. And you know, maybe Biden can really win by that margin when all is said and done. And again, he's got a pretty good record, including this week when he stood with striking UAW members. But if his numbers are not improving by the beginning of next year, I hope that Biden, his family, and close friends will ask him to step aside so the torch can be passed again to a new generation of Democratic leadership. It may be the only way we defeat fascism, and it may be the only way we keep our democratic institutions. You see, President Biden's numbers aren't the greatest right now, and it still astounds me that someone like Trump, who's facing 91 charges in 4 different indictments, and someone who is clearly a danger to our democracy, is tied or slightly winning or losing to Biden. Look, Biden's got a good record to run on, a rebounding economy, low unemployment, inflation is scaling back, the Inflation Reduction Act is doing much to help rebuild parts of our crumbling infrastructure across the country, and he got us out of the quagmire that was Afghanistan. But I said that rightly or wrongly, and we can put all kinds of blame on the press all we want, but people view Biden as past his prime. I believe I said in the Friday short how Biden's really not the same sharp Joe Biden when Jason Sudeikis played him on Saturday Night Live during the Obama years. I'm just hoping if there's any kind of nervousness or worry within the Democratic Party, that Biden would talk with family, friends, and confidants on whether it is really a good idea for him to run in 2024. Again, I like Joe, and he's exceeded my expectations. And yes, Trump is clearly losing his mind in front of all of America and is just only a couple years younger than Biden. But when democracy is hanging in the balance and the Republican Party is now fully MAGA and the fascism it wants to bring, we cannot screw around here. We can't. If Biden steps down, I'm confident that we have some strong candidates that could easily take it to Trump, like our governor, Gretchen Whitmer, whose team truly understands the power of social media to engage with younger voters. Because the Democrats are going to be successful next year, they've got to have the youth vote strongly in their column. There's Kentucky's Governor Andy Beshear, who, while he may not be the most progressive, hey, he won in a red state. I mean, I'm only saying that we have to plan for everything if 2016 didn't teach us already. Now, perhaps I'm wrong to think that I see myself as Chief Brody trying to radio in help aboard the Orca while the great white shark is attacking us, only to have some Democrats act like they're Robert Shaw and beat the radio system to smithereens with a baseball bat. Okay, so maybe it's not really all that bad. Maybe I'm overreacting. Writer Keith Owens, who helps run a podcast called We Are Speaking, posted a column in the Detroit Free Press this week where he says he refuses to believe those polls showing a close race between Biden and Trump. Owens says, and I quote, "I keep seeing polls that say the race between Trump and President Joe Biden is neck and neck, and that this is evidence of how divided this country is. I'll buy the fact that the country is divided, but it has been divided for a long, long, long time. We didn't just get that way. I do not buy the polls showing President Biden running neck and neck with a twice impeached, quadruply indicted man who has been declared a rapist by a civil court judge. America may be divided, but we're not back guano crazy either. Not the majority of us. So I'm sorry, I just don't buy it. What we should be paying attention to isn't another politically manufactured horse race designed to keep viewers breathlessly and panting. We should be focused on is the threat of a corrupted electoral process led by a desperately violent mob pulling the strings of a willing and pliable body of elected officials ready and willing to pervert the outcome of the most important and consequential election in modern American history." Now, Mr. Owens is not wrong there at all. We're seeing this kind of extremism happening not just at the national level, but also at the local level in Michigan. Now, as some of you know who've been listening to this podcast, I've spent some time covering the extreme Christian nationalist takeover of the Ottawa County Board of Commissioners so that they can enact their brand of fascism to that county. And they go by the name of Ottawa Impact. It's led by Commission Chair Joe Moss, or Fascist Joe Moss, as activist and friend of the podcast Joe Spalding calls him. The Ottawa Impact majority is working to oust the county medical chief and slash the medical department's funding because, yeah, it did something insane by trying to do something silly like save lives during the pandemic. Ottawa Impact also dissolved the county's diversity office and banned employees from participating in LGBTQ+ events. Ottawa Impact's main goal, it says, is to fight so-called tyranny within state and federal government. Well, it seems that Joe Ma certainly found ways to enrich his closest allies after he played a central role in getting bat-crap crazy Christina Caramo to lead the GOP down the fascist MAGA rabbit hole. Holland Sentinel reporter Sarah Leach wrote the following this week, so listen to this. Weeks after Ottawa County Board Chair Joe Moss nominated Christina Caramo to become the Michigan GOP chair. The party paid a business linked to Joe Moss of around $74,000 for undisclosed services, the Detroit News reported last week. The Limited Liability Corporation for Liberty was organized under the name of Moss's business partner, Joel Kallman, who confirmed to the Detroit News that Moss is a partner in the business, which has been working with the Michigan GOP. Oh, now isn't that just nice? So, just like Trump used government to enrich his properties while in the White House, it seems like Joe Moss and Christina Caramo set up a nice little side hustle game to enrich their pocketbooks while trying to say that they really care about the people. My friends over at The Still Social posted on X, soon after Ottawa County Board Joe Moss endorsed Christina Caramo for a Michigan GOP chair, a business associated with them received $75,000 from the party. Is Joe Moss entangled in questionable dealings within the Michigan GOP? Who will ensure accountability for both Moss and Christina Caramo regarding these actions and the apparent opacity? Is this the emerging modus operandi of the Michigan GOP? Is this what donors want? And former Democratic chair and friend of the podcast as well, Mark Brewer, said on X, is Ottawa Impact's political boss Joe Moss part of a bribery scheme inside the Michigan GOP? Who will hold him and Christina Caramo accountable for that and a lack of transparency? Has this become the new normal inside the Michigan GOP? GOP donors, beware. I mean, that's who these people are. They believe so much in their extremism. They believe so much in their fascism. They believe so much in their white Christian nationalist fantasy land. They believe that they are above all, that they are above everyone, which is why they believe they can profit from it. MAGA Republicans want their brand of government happening not just in Ottawa County or Livingston County, but in the entire state and the entire country. And they will fight for it through cheating, lying, and violence. I suppose that's why I'm just currently a little nervous on whether or not Joe Biden is up for the fight. But maybe I'm wrong. Please email me, leftoflansing@gmail.com. You are listening to LOL.
A podcast devoted to intelligence, sanity, and freedom, or otherwise known as progressive politics. It's Left of Lansing with your host, Pat Johnston. Need to tell Pat where he's wrong? Or do you actually want to praise Pat? leftoflansing@gmail.com is how to reach him. Here's Pat.
Hey, speaking of Joe Moss and the right-wing Ottawa Impact majority on the Ottawa County Board of Commissioners, it seems they are in a bit of a legal bind. According to Wood TV in Grand Rapids, and I'm going to quote here, a pastor who advocates for the LGBTQ+ community is suing Ottawa County, the Board of Commissioners, and Board Chair Joe Moss for religious discrimination, saying Moss did not allow him to lead an invocation because Moss personally disagrees with the pastor's religious beliefs, court documents show. The complaint was filed on Tuesday on behalf of the Reverend Jared Kramer, the priest at St. John's Episcopal Church in Grand Haven. Each commission meeting begins with an invocation or prayer, which is usually led by a church leader, according to the complaint. Before 2023, various commissioners took turns choosing who would lead the invocation, but when Moss became chair, he alone began to choose who would lead the invocation, the complaint alleged. Now, the story continues. Kramer said that he had previously led the invocation before Moss became chair, but when Kramer reached out to Moss asking to do so via both email and mail, he allegedly never heard back. The complaint accuses Moss of not responding because Moss disagrees with Kramer's religious beliefs. Kramer said his church welcomes LGBTQ+ people, and he himself has consistently advocated for including the LGBTQ+ community in religious life. Well. It seems the so-called religious freedom zealots aren't really all about religious freedom after all. But due to Joe Moss and his fellow Ottawa Impact Crystal Fascist Ottawa County taxpayers, we'll now have to pony up for this lawsuit. Isn't that just wonderful, everybody? And as the story concludes here on Wood TV, the lawsuit requested that the Board of Commissioners establish a non-discrimination policy for choosing people to lead the invocation and allow Kramer to lead invocations as well as pay punitive damages, reasonable attorney fees, and other just and equitable relief. You see, they aren't about religious freedom. They aren't Christians, because if they were, they'd actually act like Christians and love everyone for who they are. But we know better. Meanwhile, in the state legislature this week,
I watched my mother die in part because she could not afford all the medication that she needed on a fixed income. It should not take a Herculean effort for someone to get life-saving drugs. It should not break families' backs, and we cannot allow Michiganders to die needlessly because they can't afford their prescription drugs.
Now that was Democratic State Senator Kristen McDonald Rivett of Bay City on the Senate floor speaking in favor of a package of bills that will help lower the cost of prescription drugs here in the state of Michigan. As Senator McDonald Rivett said on X, we cannot wait for Congress to act when it comes to saving lives. Michiganders prescribed vital medicine. I cannot wait for extreme drug costs to come down. Michigan Senate Democrats are bringing transparency to Big Pharma and relief to families struggling to afford prescription drugs. Now, in case you didn't hear about this due to everything else that's happening in the world, Senate Democrats here in Michigan passed those bills, which will create a prescription drug affordability board. Now, this independent board will have the power to set upper payment limits on drugs sold in the state, according to Michigan Advance. And in that Michigan Advance story, it says the board would be made up of 5 members appointed by the governor, consisting of nonpartisan leaders in healthcare, economics, and the supply chain, as well as academics without a personal or financial stake in the pharmaceutical industry. Now, shockingly, Big Pharma is fighting against the creation of such a board, and equally not as shocking is that not one Senate Republican voted in favor of the bill. Why? Why are they for higher drug prices? Who is all about higher drug prices? Why do they want their constituents to have to choose between food or their health care? Why do Republicans care more about Big Pharma's bottom line and not their constituents' pocketbooks? And as MLive reports, nearly one-third of residents aged 19 to 64 years old, a state task force recently found, stopped taking their prescription drugs because of the cost. How is that good? How could Republicans not want to jump aboard this plan? Once again, bills such as these would never happen if it weren't for progressives fighting on behalf of these bills. And bills like these make sense. And it's another example of how progressive policies are popular. And for someone like Senator McDonald Rivett, who resides in a purple district, it's just another way that she can show how government combined with good governance can work for the people. Now, let's get Democrats to pass this bill in the House real soon. Another way Democrats are showing how government combined with good governance can work for the people is by passing the Clean and Affordable Energy Plan, which is currently being worked out in the state legislature. Now, I've talked about these bills in previous episodes and even had other guests talking about them as well. They would create clean energy policies, including 100% carbon-free for electricity generation by 2040, the creation of a new energy waste reduction goal and incentives program, and giving more power to the Michigan Public Service Commission, which regulates energy in the state, to consider equity, health, affordability, and climate impacts when making decisions. Now, this seems like a no-brainer, just a no-brainer to me or anybody with a thinking cap. I mean, this will work considering how climate change is already impacting us financially and how it's already impacting our environment. Oh, and let's not forget how our two main energy companies, DTE and Consumers Energy, haven't really had the greatest track record of late keeping the lights on while Michiganders pay some of the highest rates in the country for fossil fuel. So, knowing all this, why in the world is the right-wing Mackinac Center for Public Policy against these bills? You see, the MAC Center finds itself in a bit of a bind. It claims to be for the people, and is rightly calling out DTE and Consumers Energy for not providing reliable energy and for that unreliable energy being expensive, so give credit where credit is due. But at the same time, the MAC Center offers no solutions and claims that transitioning to clean energy won't work either. Oh, and it'll be a little more expensive, they claim, which is laughable considering we are already paying expensive bills for unreliable fossil fuel energy. The MAC Center, through its Michigan CapCon handle on X, says Michigan has an energy distribution problem, long, frequent power outages, and a cost problem. 100% clean energy policies would create an energy generation problem, too. All right. So, you have no solutions. We'll just keep doing the status quo. I mean, they have no solutions. Climate change is happening, and it's just not hurting our environment, as I said, but it's also hurting our overall human health. I mean, I've already talked about how Detroit ranks in the top 10 when it comes to asthma rates in the country. Oh, and here's another one from the Max Center on X. They said, do you know how different life in Michigan would be if Attorney General Dana Nessel succeeds and shuts down Line 5? Okay. See, they're all shaking in their boots that if Attorney General Nessel is victorious in shutting down Line 5, that it'll lead to a different life in Michigan? Yeah, that's the whole point. Shutting down that 70-year-old pipeline, which distributes oil and gas from Canada through the Straits of Mackinac down to Sarnia, will indeed change the state for the better. And the Graham Sustainability Institute from the University of Michigan did a study recently showing that if or when Line 5 ruptures, more than 700 miles of shoreline in Lakes Michigan and Huron and on their islands are potentially vulnerable to an oil release in the straits. But I guess that's just worth the cost to ensure that Enbridge Oil continues to rake in the cash. Oh, and by the way, studies have also shown that closing down the pipeline will have negligible impacts on oil and gas prices in the region, including propane costs in the UP. But that's who the Mackinac Center is fighting for. It's fighting for big oil and big gas. It's why the Mackinac Center is against the transition to electric vehicles, which are happening anyway around the world, and auto companies are already making that transition. Now, I do find common ground with the people at the Max Center when it comes to corporate welfare, although I'm for some state spending on corporations if it will help the people overall. But I find it untenable for the Mackinac Center to criticize our high energy prices for unreliable energy from fossil fuels, but then say moving to clean energy in the future will only make things more expensive and unreliable. I mean, they're basically saying there's nothing that we can do here. Just keep the cash flowing to big oil and big gas. And they also want to ignore how building a clean energy system in Michigan will not only be a boon to our economy, but it will also diversify our economic portfolio as well. And it will also help bring in people to the state who may want to get those jobs. But no. Let's just keep with the status quo. You see, the Mackinac Center wants us to ignore the future and live in the past. Well, I guess that's the entire right-wing playbook in a nutshell, right?
It's the Left of Lansing podcast. If you truly want to get Pat fired up, talk about Tigers baseball or how you think the 90s produced the worst music of any decade. You've been warned. Email him at leftoflansing@gmail.com and follow him on Twitter at leftoflansing. Here's Pat.
Hey, please remember to give Michigan's premier progressive podcast a good rating wherever you listen to your podcast. And you can subscribe to leftoflansing.com. That's where you can get a full archive of my episodes, my Friday Left of Lansing shorts, and my daily musings in writing. That's leftoflansing.com. And let me thank my good friend Rich on all of his hard work on creating such a stellar site. Time now for the Left of Lansing last call. So while I was washing dishes recently, I rewatched one of my favorite stand-up comedian specials of all time, and it was by the late great George Carlin. It was called Jammin' in New York from 1991. I remember watching that live on HBO in the basement of my childhood home in Redford Township, and it was something that I frankly had never seen before from a comedian. I think that's because the Persian Gulf War had just ended, and there was so much of what happened in the lead up and then in the war itself, which just didn't sit well with me, but I couldn't really express it. I was sort of afraid to say much about these conflicting feelings as a 14-year-old because, well, most of my friends, many adults, and corporate mass media all seemed pro-war at that time, so maybe I was in the huge minority. But then in the first 10 minutes of his routine, George Carlin mostly expressed what I was feeling during those months. And he attacked the military-industrial complex, the media for being a communications arm of that complex, and most of all, the absurdity of war itself. However, it was after those first 10 minutes that Carlin moved on to discuss things in everyday life that happens to everyday people, and he said he wanted to talk about them to show how all these experiences that we share help bring us all together. I do think that we are way too political in our everyday lives and that not everything has to have a political angle. Yes, this is a political podcast, and I will rail against those trying to subvert our democratic institutions through Christian nationalist fascism. And I want to show off all the hard work many progressives across the state are doing since, for years, the corporate media ignored them. But when it comes to how politicized our culture has become, I do believe it has led all of us to fight about anything and everything. And I don't think that's good. That's a problem because we fail to not only understand people, but we fail to understand, or we just fail to simply communicate with them. I've told you plenty of times about my time working in right-wing talk radio. I loved radio and always had a love for radio ever since I was a boy. So getting a job in radio was a dream, but working in talk radio was a dream come true. I knew what I was getting into, though, when I started working at my last radio station in the Great Lakes Bay region. I knew the right-wing syndicated programming the station featured and celebrated, all right, even before I reached out for a job. Now, while the station featured those national right-wing talkers, the station featured local shows from 5:30 in the morning till noon. I thought that was cool. I mean, I respected the localism that station also celebrated, and I had high respect for the station's news department, which for the most part covered important stories across the listening area. And those stories were well-researched, well-written, and well-produced. There were a lot of fine people who worked in that newsroom. And I wanted to be part of that station which celebrated localism. That's why I got into radio. However, spending about a year there, and I'm talking around 2007 and 08, I was ready to finally branch out and do what I do best, make people think, share opinions that'll hopefully make some people pause for just a moment, and that maybe perhaps everything they believed might be wrong or misguided. But above all, I wanted to entertain. That's why I got into radio. I wanted to make listeners laugh at times. And I wanted them knowing that even if they don't agree with me on certain issues, or even if they never agreed with me, you know what? They would hear me and say, that's okay, though. I may disagree with Pat, but he's kind of down to earth. And we do have some things that we can agree on. You know, there are some commonalities in life in which we can say, all right, yeah, we see eye to eye there. And through time, many of the station's listeners did like me, but I know others couldn't stand me. Hey, that is the entertainment business. It's just how it is. Not everyone is going to like you. But like I said, it was 2008, and I was ready to let listeners know where I really stood on issues. And you have to remember, that's the year of the subprime mortgage crash and the rise of Barack Obama. Now, the station had, and still has, a local host who's been there for years. And once I got there, I immediately could tell why he was the face of the station. He was personable, relatable, and to many, many people, especially those around his age, and he was conversational. That being said, he was very, very right-wing. Even though he tried to describe himself as a moderate, he wasn't. It always made me laugh how he would always try to say he was moderate. But I knew that if I was going to make a dent at the station, and if people were really going to get to know the real Pat Johnston, what he was all about, I knew I would have to call this host out when I thought he was grossly incorrect and grossly wrong. We had some fun moments on his show, as I would call in while driving home, or we'd debate off the air many, many times. But a couple of years later, in 2010, I had the chance to guest host the Morning Drive show, finally, which meant I was in control of the show while this longtime host would join me halfway in the show and offer commentary on the news, sports, and things happening around the area and the world. Okay, so this is 2010. There was this huge uproar over a proposed Islamic community center being constructed blocks away from where the World Trade Centers used to stand. Now, New York City leaders passed the funding resolution for the site to be built, but then the right-wing media arm funded by big-time donors picked up the story and used anti-Muslim rhetoric to stoke fear amongst its consumers over this building. And they would call this community center the Ground Zero Mosque. All right, again, was just to stoke fear amongst its right-wing consumers. And due to the expansive and effective right-wing media machine, many polls showed that the majority of Americans were against the construction of such a building at that site. And the community center, from my understanding, still has never really fully been built due to money and other issues. But I remembered how this one proposed building drove up the ire of many of my station's listeners. And it didn't help that the longtime host was part of that overall communication arm stoking fears over this mosque. For weeks, I heard he and his listeners complain about this proposed Islamic community center and how its construction was like spitting in the eyes of those who lost loved ones on 9/11. I viewed that kind of argument and those kinds of comments not just cynical politicalization of something that wasn't really dividing downtown Manhattan, many miles away from our station, by the way, but that it was just downright racist and Islamophobic. Now, I'm agnostic, and I don't exactly know what happens to us when we part from this mortal world. I have my strong beliefs that when we're gone, but I don't know for sure. But that also means I'm not the biggest fan when it comes to organized religion either. I mean, if it helps you, more power to you. Just don't insist that I have to live in your religious way. And that goes for all religions. But it was really obvious that the right wing during that time was really playing on Islamophobia. And for those of you who remember what it was like here in the United States after 9/11, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So I had this chance to finally host the station's morning drive show. And that's when I decided on my own, that I would challenge the longtime host on his views about this Islamic center. I took the chance knowing it would probably ruffle some feathers of my bosses and the listeners. But you know what? I went with it because I knew, above anything else, it would be entertaining. And I came prepared for battle. I mean, I knew the longtime host would come at me with polls showing how I was in the minority. I just knew he'd do it because he talked about those polls ad nauseum. That proved that the American people were right to him, which meant that he was right. So I countered that argument in this way, and I'll explain. I spun around, this is while on the air, by the way, I spun around the studio computer screen and showed him a Gallup poll from, I think it was from the late 60s, showing how a solid majority of Americans opposed interracial marriage. I believe it was done around the landmark Supreme Court case, the Loving case. I think that's when it was done. Anyway, I then asked the longtime host, were the American people wrong back then? And he knew exactly. He knew fast where I was going. You see, we know the American people were wrong when a majority opposed interracial marriage back in the late 1960s. He knew I was arguing that if the American people were wrong on that issue way back then, is it possible that they were wrong on this one? Now, the longtime host tried to think of ways around it, but I quite frankly badgered him on the air and asked him again, were the American people wrong? And because he couldn't give in to this 32-year-old kid on the air in front of his friends and fans, he responded, I'll never forget this, by saying, maybe. I asked him again. I said, want to clarify that? Were they wrong? And he said again, maybe. I mean, he could not admit that I simply made a good point, and I pressed him on it. I pressed him on it a couple times, I was trying to save him from sounding, well, racist. So I asked one more time. I said, were the American people wrong when they said that they were against interracial marriage? And he once again said, maybe. He just would not give in. And before I forget, I would just quickly like to say that I worked with this longtime host for many years. Again, while he voted Republican, while he normally was on the Republican side, I never pegged him as a racist. That is not what I am saying whatsoever. Not at all. I'm just saying that he cornered himself that day because he just simply would not see the point that I made. He just wouldn't simply say, okay, fine, Pat, I see your point. Let's move on. No, he just couldn't do that. He could not claim defeat. The exchange drew lots of response on social media, on our station's social media, and many were not happy with me. And I knew that was probably going to be the case. I mean, I received some positive emails from listeners thanking me for providing the other side of the argument, but also for taking it to the longtime host. Now, about 8 years later, I answered one of the station's phones, and a listener knew it was me when I picked up the phone. We talked about sports, since that was my main job there. And then the listener told me that, you know, he said, I don't want to make you feel bad, but I never listen to you whenever you host. Even if you're not being political, I still don't listen. I said, why? And he said, I just never really liked the way you treated the longtime host that day. I never forgot it. And I was like, wow, that was like 7-8 years ago. And you remember that? And he said, yep, I just didn't like it. I've replayed that day in my head many, many times. And I wondered if I ended up doing the opposite of what I intended. And my conclusion is, you know what? Yes. Yes, I did handle it correctly. Sure, I may have been abrasive. Sure, I may have been in your face. And sure, I made people feel uncomfortable. But no, I don't regret how I approached that debate on that given morning. It was needed. Those kinds of things needed to be said. Hypocrisy and also wrong-headedness had to be confronted. I don't regret it. But what I do regret is making the listeners feel like the longtime host and I never got along, that we never, ever saw eye to eye. And funny enough, there were times through the years that we would both admit when the other person may have had a point. may have had a point. The longtime host and I actually would develop a good relationship, good working relationship through time. Sure, we'd still get into some heated arguments on and off the air, but I don't think we never really made it personal. I made it a fact never to make it personal again between us. And that's because he and I could talk about other things and get along, like sports, work, cooking. He was easily the expert there. And we could talk about family. Yes, again, his opinions at times would drive me up the wall, and I'm sure mine did as well, but we worked on actually getting to know each other. We worked on trying to find some things that would bring us together. I know, unfortunately, that's simply not the case with some people. You won't be able to do that. But you know what? I'm always going to try. That's why I said on last week's podcast, I hope that people who agree with me aren't my only listeners. I want people who disagree with me to also listen in and to also contact me at leftoflansing@gmail.com and tell me where you think I am wrong. That's the whole point. I'm all about being fair-minded. I'm all about having an open mind and listening to the other side. However, that doesn't mean that I will not fight for what I believe in. But I am always going to try to be conversational and to be respectful. I know, unfortunately, that's simply not the case with some people. Some of the people I have already talked about here today. But you know what? I'm still always going to try to be respectful. And of course, for those of you who do listen and disagree with me, I'm always going to try to make you see that I'm always right, of course. You're listening to LOL.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan. It's Pat Johnston.
Well, that will do it for this edition of Left of Lansing. And again, I'm always telling you that we have to fight for our progressive values and beliefs since they are popular, they work, and they're common sense. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to find some common ground with people, since there's a lot to bring us together, and perhaps that is the best way to convince some out there to join in our fight. Next week, Sarah Lazare from Workday Magazine will join me to discuss the importance of unions and the UAW fight against the big three Detroit automakers. Please reach me at leftoflansing@gmail.com or on Twitter or X, Facebook, and the Instagram. And if you'd ever like to make a small donation to this cause, please do so at leftoflansing.com. Thanks again, and now I'm off to get my COVID booster. I don't have the guts to do both the COVID booster and the flu shot at the same time. It's like allowing your food to mix on the dinner plate. Some people love it, but I prefer plates with dividers. And that's the same with my vaccines. Hey, no judging out there. And congrats to our Detroit Tigers on a rather entertaining season as we say so long to one of the greatest Tigers ever, Miguel Cabrera. Now, the Tigers move on to the next chapter, and I think it's going to be fun with some good young talent like Spencer Turnbull, Riley Green, and Tarek Skubal. But in the meantime, it's starting to feel like fall, and that means everyone's got Lions fever. I think the state will blow its top if they win this Sunday against Carolina and improve to 4-1. 4-1? I don't think Lions fans will know how to handle that kind of, what do you call it, success. Remember, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan.
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston. Written by Pat Johnston. Researched by Pat Johnston. Edited by Pat Johnston. And hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.